You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, April 17th, 2019, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
And we have a special guest rogue this week, James Hart. James, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Hello there. Welcome from England.
Hello, James.
So James just got through telling us that it's 1 o'clock in the morning where you are.
Yeah, it's a little bit past my bedtime, I have to say.
James, tell us a little bit about yourself.
So yeah, I'm a software engineer based in Brighton, currently working at a cool startup. And yeah, I've been a long time listener. I'm pretty sure I've listened to every single episode. I didn't quite start at the beginning, but I've kind of moved back and like a very, very long time ago. So yeah, it's almost half of my life that I've been listening to The Skeptic's Guide. It's absolutely astounding to me.
How old are you?
Wow.
I'm turning 30 this year.
Yeah, it's 14 years. It's almost half your life. A couple more years it will be.
Wow.
Right?
it's completely mind-blowing. I don't understand it. So
that's amazing.
Neither do we. James, so you said you've been, you know, you've listened to most of the episodes, if not all of them, especially. How do we compare now to the older episodes to, you know, say 13, 14 years ago?
I was thinking about introducing with the whole, you know, the Bob sort of hello.
No. Hello.
Hello. Oh my God, that will never die.
No, podcasts are forever.
Wasn't me. Well, that lets you know that I did actually listen to that one. So,
James, how realistic is the show Silicon Valley? Since you work at a startup,
it's almost a little bit too close to home. Does that make sense?
Like, yeah,
I just don't know if I can listen to it.
I know what you mean.
Yeah, I can't.
It's like we watch it. Like when I watch like a medical show, like ER or whatever. It's like, oh, they wouldn't do it that way. That's stupid. Why are they doing that? It's just, it's kind of hard to get past that if you're too close to the material.
No, absolutely.
Unfortunately, we've got a couple of depressing things to talk about because of just
well, the first one is that Kara is not here.
Oh, that's a shame.
But it's a good reason actually for her. She has a gig which we can't tell you about because it's a secret. Because you know, because she's always she's in the filming stage. You know, and this is a new project. But I'm sure you'll hear about it when it airs. But
well, I mean, she is a TV personality.
Yeah. So no, this was when we, you know, contracted with her to be on the SU. This was like, we knew this was going to happen. There's going to be a few episodes a year where she's going to be filming, and it's just not going to be possible to have her on. That's not a big deal. So it's a perfect time to have on a guest rogue, because whenever we're one rogue down, that's when we like to fill in that slot. Yeah. Like Evan was absent last week, so we replaced him. So you're Kara for this episode.
Well, yeah, hopefully I measure up.
Yeah. So, well, we will see, won't we? We're going to start by talking about Notre Dame.
Oh, yeah, so sad.
Yeah, so it's like this is the big news for the week. I always wonder how much this dates our show. Like, so James, when you listen to a show from 5 or 10 years ago and we're talking about something in the news, it's like time travel, right?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
So anyway, so Notre Dame caught fire earlier in the week. So what we know so far, we don't know what caused it, but the working theory is that it was an accident. It could have been a, you know, worker error, like a discarded cigarette. It could have been an electrical short. But here's the thing that they do know. It started in the attic and the fire alarm did go off, but there was a glitch in the fire system and it actually directed them to the wrong place of the cathedral. And so they searched for like 20 minutes and couldn't find it.
Oh my God.
I think the time is 23 minutes.
God.
Then at 23 minutes later, a second alarm went off. And then by the time they found the fire, it was basically too late. It was running along the rafters and it was far gone.
You've got those timbers. They were something insane, like sort of 300 years old.
Yeah,
like,
really.
Oh, more than that. I heard they were from the year 1200.
Really dry wood.
Yeah, and also the reconstruction that took place in the 19th century, they used more wood to do it. Even though there was technology to use metal, steel, and other things, they decided to keep it real, as it were, with wood.
Yeah. And then there was probably dust and other flammable objects around.
Absolutely.
And then the structure of the cathedral itself made it hard to douse the fire. They couldn't really get access to the part that was burning. They couldn't get access to it from the ground. They basically had to wait for the lead to melt and before they could get the hoses to where the fire was. So it burned out the spire, the famous spire in the middle, and the wood.
So sad seeing that fall down.
The wood roofing, along the cross shape in the middle. The stone structures, they say the stone is probably sound, structurally sound, but they still have to inspect it because they said, who knows how well 800-year-old limestone fared, under this system, under that fire. I also found out, prepping for this, that they had an opportunity to upgrade the building to make it more fire resistant, and they did not do it. Other big cathedrals in Europe did do it. So they didn't replace the wood or put in fire barriers to limit the spread of the fire. And nope, they decided no sprinkler system.
Gee whiz.
Yeah, I think they're just going to have to update. So like with many disasters, right, it's also an opportunity. Obviously, there's a loss of some history here of traditional beauty. They're saying it's going to take 6 years to basically shut it down for 6 years and reconstruct it. But they have an opportunity to make it even better than it was before, So this will be the famous fire of, 2019, and there'll be hopefully a lot of upgrades, and I strongly suspect they'll make it a lot more fire resistant. But basically, you have the cathedral was built. They started construction. You guys know when?
1150?
1160. And the majority of the construction was done in 1260, so 100 years.
Wow.
But then there was, it depends. I read different dates depending on when you count that it was quote unquote finished. There were sort of major upgrades and additions and whatever over the next even more like 80 years or so. But officially, it was basically done in 1260. So 100 years. You have a building this old, 800 whatever year old structure. These things are going to happen, and this wasn't the first damage to be done to the cathedral, but it is very sad whenever anything destructive like this happens, but that's kind of the life story of these, huge ancient buildings. Is things happen, they rebuild, they update, they reconstruct. So this will just be one more chapter in the history of this building. It's not totally destroyed, which is great. It was really just mostly the wood parts to it.
Yeah, but Steve, I haven't been able to get any sense of what was destroyed that's irreplaceable. I mean, you could rebuild the structure, but what has there been any identified and released artwork that this is gone? We will never see.
Well,
this
I heard
again.
All the totally the stained glass windows are what I read. I don't know if there's other artwork. There probably
no.
Was.
Actually, first of all, like anything we say tonight, the information changes pretty quickly.
Yeah,
but like the primary stained glass window survived is what I heard. And I saw pictures of it after the fire. I saw someone had taken a video inside. The big circular stained glass window had survived.
That's good.
What they're trying to do now is they're trying to stabilize the building to make sure that it doesn't keep falling in or lose any more of it. And then they're going to let the inspectors come in to do a legitimate inspection to really figure out exactly what happened, which could take some time. Other facts I heard. Lots of people donated a lot of money.
Yeah.
Billionaires donating hundreds of millions of dollars, multiple instances of this.
It's an icon. I mean, it's obviously in Paris, and it's an icon of Paris and of France. And it is basically the most, I think, dramatic icon of Gothic architecture, European Gothic architecture. It's the most significant historical building.
I'd say so.
But it's beyond iconic. Yeah. This is the kind of thing that is so culturally priceless that they really deserved, it really needed to be protected extra. Something, this is such an amazing thing. It's just so sad that this could have been prevented if it wasn't in multiple steps along the way. This could have been prevented, and they neglected. I'm still shocked to hear that they neglected to take some precautionary measures that would have saved this. All this damage, and who knows what's irreplaceable.
So there's already, of course, any big event happened, there's already conspiracy theories, zipping around the internet.
Who did it this time?
Well, it was pretty much
Macron.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I think probably the most common one is that it was deliberate and it was terrorism.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, anytime there's uncertainty, you know that those sorts of ideas and elements are going to enter the equation. It was expected, basically, as soon as
we
were watching this unfold on television. You sort of knew that this was going to be the case.
Yeah, I mean, there's no way that there was not going to be conspiracy theories.
Yeah, I mean, look, is it a conspiracy theory for someone to think, you know, hey, this could have been terrorism? Like, sure, it could have been terrorism. But, you know, like, we can't say...
Yeah, it's not implausible.
When it's happening, unless the terror organization is claiming that they did it, you really just got to, like, keep that under wraps and wait until a legit investigation is done.
Well, I think it was covered in scaffolding, wasn't it? So, I mean, like, it's such an easy thing to happen in massive works like that. Like, you're just going to have accidents that happen. Yeah.
Sure, there's so many prosaic explanations for how it could have happened. You don't have to make these leaps into totally unsubstantiated ideas.
Let's move on to some news items. So I have sort of a love-hate relationship with the FDA. I mean, obviously, they have a very critical role to play, the Food and Drug Administration, in regulating not only food products, but also drugs, of course, and over-the-counter, as well as prescription and supplements, et cetera. So they serve a critical role. And in a lot of ways, they sort of get, you know, there are smart people in the FDA who get it, who know what they're supposed to be doing, but they're kind of hamstrung. They don't really have the power or the resources to do what they're supposed to do. So it's just frustrating. But here's a perfect example of my frustration. So the FDA comes out with some guidelines, right? They're more guidelines than rules.
Somebody had to say it. Thank you.
This is for labeling of food products as to whether or not they contain genetically modified organisms, right?
Oh, boy.
Now, some of the regulations are just sort of the common sense things that you would imagine, like what constitutes a GMO, and, you know, most substances are not actually the organisms themselves, but they're derived from a GMO. But what's interesting is they touch on how you can deceive the public with information that's technically true, but that is giving a deliberate misperception, right? It's creating an impression. It's implying something that isn't true because it's either selective or because, well, you'll see. So one thing, for example, is like if you have on a product, let's say, you know, their example is, I'm just going to quote the FDA now, FDA, because this is what they say, and it's exactly correct. They say, for example, on a product made largely of flour derived from genetically engineered corn and a small amount of non-genetically engineered soybean oil, a claim that the product, quote, does not contain bioengineered soybean oil could be misleading if consumers believe that the entire product or a larger portion of it than is actually the case is free of bioengineered material. So, right, that's one example of a way in which the label could be 100% correct, but is deliberately selective in order to create a misperception. Because whenever something is on a label, it creates an assumption about why are you bothering to state that, right? This goes all the way to for example, so if you say that something is GMO-free, that can't possibly be GMO. That's another type of deception. Example, like, you know, we talked about this, like with gluten-free water, right? This is the same thing. If you say, yeah, this is non-GMO salt. Okay. Well, there's no such thing as salt derived from a genetically modified organism or that is a GMO.
Yeah.
It's the negative claim deception. Whenever you claim that something is not something or something is absent, it makes it seem like that's a thing, right? Like, okay, so other products do have it, you know? So like, for example, some examples I come up with, it's like saying this product contains only cruelty-free sugar. So what, some sugar is not cruelty-free? I mean, that's the implication. It's true,
right.
You know, it's true. Or calorie-free salt. Well, salt doesn't have calories. Or you could say these are fat-free jelly beans. You know, jelly beans are basically, I mean, I think they're pure sugar, right? And I think like Twizzlers says that. Twizzlers is a fat-free snack. Yeah, it's pure sugar. That's why it's fat-free.
It's also protein-free.
And delicious.
And delicious. I love Twizzlers. That's my go-to movie snack.
Oh, they're great.
When I do that sort of thing. So that's a way of deceiving with the truth, right? You say something is doesn't contain something that nothing contains. You know, it's like if you have a peanut butter and you say, we have no excrement in our peanut butter. It's like, well, I'm proud of you, but are you saying that your competitors do have it in their product? I mean, what are you saying?
Pat yourself on the back, wipe yourself on the ass.
Right. So that's another way to see. So this gets to the non-GMO project, right? The non-GMO project is a, you know, ostensibly not-for-profit organization that charges a licensing fee to license their non-GMO label. So you could slap it on your food. You basically have to go through a process where they certify that your product is GMO-free, and then you get to put their label on it. But they will put it on things for which it is not possible for there to be a GMO option. Like water or salt or things that contain, you know, like wheat. There's no GMO wheat or there's no GMO tomatoes. So if you have tomato sauce, GMO-free tomato sauce, 100% of it is GMO-free. And so the label is meaningless, but it's a negative claim that is meant to deceive. But of course, here's the biggest one, right? And the FDA does address this as well. And that is when you say that something, it would be similar to saying that this product contains no poison, whatever. Just choose what poison.
Right.
You
arsenic.
Could name it. Yeah, this is arsenic free. Okay. is there arsenic in other versions of this thing? But it's also, you know, if you say, you could say that it doesn't have something that is completely safe, but by the fact that you're going out of your way to say it doesn't have the thing, you're implying that that's a virtue, right?
This is a marketing scheme.
Yeah, so you're implying that it's not safe, that something is not safe. So you could say, like, this contains no alanine, which is like an amino acid. Okay, 100% alanine-free. That could be true. Like, Twizzlers are 100% alanine-free. But, you know, that's just a way of fear-mongering, right, of scaring the public. I think, well, I don't know what that is. But I don't want it in my food. I don't know if other versions of the competitors, you know, have alanine in it. And so I better buy this product just to be on the safe side, right? That's what they want the customers to think.
Of course. It's obvious.
Yeah. So that's what the whole GMO-free thing is about. That's it in a nutshell, is to create fear about something which is not dangerous, which you shouldn't worry about, in order to create this negative claim and create a health halo around products that are free of this thing that's not a problem in the first place.
Sounds very straw man-ish in a way.
Yeah. It's poisoning the well. You know, it's sort of claiming by implication or by what you're not saying, you know, but it's meant to create a market through deception. That's the bottom line. Now, the FDA, they totally get it, right? You read their guidelines, and they completely understand what's happening in the industry, how they're using fear-mongering around GMOs to promote products. So what they say is – so they can't say, because of the law, right, because of federal law in the United States, they can't say that you can't voluntarily label your product as GMO-free. But so they say that can be deceptive if on the same label – whether it says GMO-free or not produced through modern biotechnology or whatever, if on the same label they imply that as a result of not being produced through modern biotechnology, I'm quoting them now, such vegetables or whatever are safer, more nutritious, or have different attributes than other foods solely because the food was not produced using modern biotechnology. That right there totally gets it. That's the problem, is that you're implying, you know, in the labeling, that by saying GMO-free, that you're saying it's therefore safer or more nutritious. But the FDA can't categorically ban that. So they just have to say, you can't explicitly say on the label, therefore our food is better for you or is more safe or whatever. But unfortunately, these are all just guidelines. They have zero teeth. Corporations are 100% free to completely ignore these recommendations, because the FDA simply does not have the authority to enforce them. Or maybe they're just floating this idea to see how people respond. And maybe they might try to enforce them under some rationale. I don't know. But I suspect they just simply don't have the authority to do it, which is unfortunate. So they just – I often say, like, the FDA – just sends a strongly worded letter, you know.
But what's the point? You know, I know that I'm not completely up on the daily machinations of the FDA, but, like, what the hell are they doing? Like, this is what they should be doing specifically. Like, we should be seeing things rolled out like this multiple times a year.
So the FDA, I mean, they do. The FDA is doing what they can, but remember, the FDA is a creature of Congress. It only has the power that Congress directly gives to it. And Congress has been defanging the FDA over the, you know, the last decades, because senators, in the thrall of the supplement industry and the food industry, whatever, have been lobbied to do exactly that. So unfortunately, this is what we have. You know, it's like there are many other countries in the Western world or the English speaking world that have far better regulations than the U.S. does, just because this, because the FDA has been deliberately weakened in this regard.
If I make a product, I'm going to say it contains natural atoms.
Yeah. It's 100% plutonium free.
Well, how do you know, Steve?
You could put a Geiger counter next to it, I guess.
That's You could sell the Geiger counter as well.
Very frustrating. All right. Speaking of plutonium, although this is not – this is only tangentially related to plutonium. Speaking of nuclear stuff, how about that?
Nuclear.
Jay, how long until we have tabletop fusion?
Oh.
You know, Steve, it could be not soon.
5-10 years?
This is a little story about a very small possible future fusion reactor. Let's go through it. So fusion power has been in the news a lot because, you guys know, the latest advancements with reactor technology. They're making steady strides with the larger fusion reactors. I read about it all the time. I'm fascinated by it. A quick way that it works is that under immense pressure, two hydrogen atoms will join to become a helium atom, right? So, and what happens is they use a magnetic field to hold in the plasma, which is like condensed hydrogen, and they squeeze it together and they squeeze it together and they squeeze it together. And then eventually the pressure becomes so much and the heat becomes so much that these atoms will begin to fuse. Now, what happens when they fuse? There's a byproduct. Neutrons are released and an incredible amount of energy. It's damn near like the perfect way to generate energy, in my opinion. It's clean and it's very safe. But these reactors are pretty big, right? The ones that will probably end up functioning are big. They're super complicated. There are more bells and whistles and switches and knobs and lights and electrical connections and cooling systems and heating systems, everything. It's like just a mass of science fiction prop-looking awesomeness.
Let me give one aside, Jay, before you move on. So the big limiting factor with these large fusion reactors, like a tokamak reactor, which is like a torus of magnets trying to hold it in place, or there's also the stellarators, which use external magnetic fields, but they both have essentially the same problem, is that as you get the plasma, which is, you know, hydrogen atoms stripped of their electrons, as you get the plasma hot enough to cause the fusion, they also get unstable. The flow gets very unstable. So that's the limiting factor that we're running up to right now, which is why, you know, some people think it's 20 years away and it always will be, because even though we're making these incremental advances, we're still running up against this fundamental problem of controlling the plasma. However, I just, as unrelated news item today, researchers are now using artificial intelligence to speed up research into these fusion reactors by essentially calculating what, you know, structure will optimally control the plasma, right?
So that's exactly what we should be using AI for.
So controlling that flow so it doesn't get into problems, basically, and shut down the reaction. That's because, unfortunately, that's what happens now. We can get it to fuse for like microseconds, but then the chaos comes into play. So we'll see. Maybe the time horizon will be shortened by these, by using AI to speed up the research. Yeah, some kind of neural net based AI algorithm.
So just to give you more quick sideline information here, this thing that's happening in the fusion reactor, it's the same thing that gives hydrogen bombs their explosive power. It's what the sun is doing nonstop. Yeah. I mean, the sun is a big fusion reactor. And again, fusion is safer, cleaner, more efficient than the fission version of this that is what we use today, right? Fission is, you know, even though fission is great and it is a great way to create energy, there is danger, as you everybody knows, because of recent things that have happened over the last decade. And there's a byproduct that's hard to deal with. So this technology that we're talking about today, it's called Zeta Pinch or Z Pinch. And researchers at the University of Washington in the United States have been working on ways to get around some of the flaws that come with this technology. The tech was initially developed in the early days of fusion back in the 50s, right? It's pretty cool. It goes way back. The way that Z-Pinch technology is supposed to work is that it shoots a jet of plasma through a magnetic field that actually squeezes it through a magnetic bottleneck, right? So imagine the plasma is being forced to go through a very small aperture that could be 3 or 4 feet long, say. And this forces the fusion to occur, right? Sounds pretty simple. Now, the technology was developed for the Z-Pinch was eventually used for the tokamak, which Steve mentioned before. Like that early work that they did scaled up to the fusion reactors that we're working on today. So, you know, that the work and time that they put into that back then was definitely worth it. So the researchers at the University of Washington believe that they found an alternate method that can stabilize the plasma in the Z-Pinch device. I thought I should explain to you why the letter Z. Z is on, you know, the X, Y, and Z. If you look at like a three-dimensional chart, it's the Z-plane, which is a common plane that you would see on one of those charts, right? So they just say it's going horizontal, so it's Z. What they came up with was that using the concepts taken from fluid dynamics, and this is called sheared axial flow, they used computer simulations as a proof of concept. And what this means is that the plasma is not static. It's made to flow through the magnetic bottleneck. This is the update that they came up with. It's not just sitting there. They're flowing it through and cycling it through. They had to use a 20% deuterium and 80% hydrogen mix. They were able to hold a 50 centimeter or 1.6 foot long column of plasma, and they achieved fusion for 5 microseconds. Now, even though this lasts a lot longer than Bob's typical sexual encounter, it's a very good sign. Thank you, James. The researchers said that it's 5,000 times longer than what they can achieve without using the fluid dynamics method. That's a huge improvement, and it's a proof of concept that there's something happening here that they need to investigate. Now, as usual, progress has been made, but nothing on the level where people should start getting excited. If they're able to figure out how to make the fusion cycle last longer, then it's possible that maybe a future iteration of this device could be used. If it's small, fantastic. You know, the headline is such a joke. I mean, the headline was researchers just demonstrated nuclear fusion in a device small enough to keep at home. The implication that you could keep it at home just because it's small. Sorry, there's a laboratory of wires and connections still hooked up to this thing, even though it's relatively small. I hate the way they do that.
It's not self-contained. Annoying. Yeah.
No, I mean, right. But still, this is great. And it's good that we're working on different ways of getting to the finish line. Imagine, though, can we have fun for a second? Imagine if they could miniaturize this, because it is a lot smaller than a tokamak. It could mean that we have reactors in lots of places. You know,
like on a ship, you know, for example.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. That's what I was going to say. So anyway, it's fun. It's interesting. But this is not something that's going to be in your home.
Right. Plus 5 microseconds is 5 microseconds.
Yeah, right.
Right. That's the thing. It's 5,000 times longer than you'd expect without this method, but it's still 5 microseconds worth of fusion happening. It's not anywhere near sustainable fusion that's generating energy.
Divide 5 microseconds by 5,000.
That's what it was
That's where they were last week. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. And unfortunately, it takes a lot of energy to get to that. Right. So the amount of energy that we're putting in is much greater than the energy that comes out of that 5 microseconds. That's the problem. Mm. It needs to last long enough that we get all the energy back plus more. You know, so
then I always wonder what the makeup of the energy that goes into these fusion experiments are. Like, do they try and use, like, obviously they're connected to the grid, but it just feels a bit like they're cheating.
I get
that sense. Yeah.
Well, if they were claiming that they were producing energy, but really it was just the energy they were pulling off the grid, that's like every free energy device, right?
Yeah, cold fusion.
A lot of times they'll do that. They're really cheating. They have some
perpetual motion.
Yeah, you know, James, source of energy.
You don't hear any of these perpetual motion people saying, things like, hey, the thing actually like kind of worked for 5 microseconds. You know, you know, they're saying it, you know, like the joke
it works,
is like
it's going to solve everything.
Right.
Yeah, that's like, right.
They're
claiming.
The scientists are like totally transparent. They're not trying to fake it because, man, you can't fake this. What do you mean? Okay, let's say you fake it. Then what? Then it doesn't work. You know, like, hey, we did it. Yeah. Well, actually, we didn't. It's like, it's just ridiculous. Right.
Yeah, you're not going to be running a city off of it, you know? Yeah. All right, James, you're going to tell us about light pollution in the UK.
Yeah, holy cow. I mean, bringing the news from Blighty even.
Yeah.
Brighty, Brighton, Bright, whatever. Yeah, it's like what is it at the moment? It's 2:10 here.
Give me a break. So you're suffering from like. Yeah, right. You're suffering the light pollution as we speak.
Yeah, precisely. So yeah, the Campaign to Protect Rural England has recently published a result of survey showing that 2%, literally 2% of England, Old Blighty, have a truly starry night sky. Not the whole UK, I might ask, literally just England. So, we're pretty crowded here. You in the States have a lot more wilderness. I mean, don't you all live in the woods, most of you now?
That's what Kara thinks.
Yeah, according to Kara.
According to Kara, we're in Wyoming somewhere.
I'd say according to me as well. So, but yeah, the survey asked people to count the stars in the Orion constellation. And well over half, like 57%, could not see 10 stars in the Orion constellation.
Sad.
And normally that's pretty bright. You can make out the belt. You can make out everything else. Like you could, if you've witnessed a dark sky, like that's popping out at you. So yeah, I'm hoping everyone that listens to the show has experienced a truly dark sky moment and seeing the Milky Way, the more bright objects and you can count just a brilliant blanket of universe awesomeness.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it is.
But I'd really like to know the true effects of not being able to regularly experience this, like it's like on the effects on people's outlook on life, their mood, how often they get confronted with the sheer massiveness and majesty of the cosmos. But yeah, it's a bit of a joke. I mean, artificial light at night can rob people of their sleep, harm wildlife. With the incessant rise of LEDs, it's just getting ever cheaper and easier to just flood our entire world with light 24/7. I mean, light just doesn't respect any sort of reasonable boundaries. But yeah, I mean, on the flip side, street lights, they offer a great deal of safety. But yeah, what cost to society? I'd love to see sort of organized shut off events, like turn off events where they like towns and cities take off all of their lights for sort of, I don't know, 10 minutes when the conditions are right, just to let everyone gaze into the stars and see what they're missing. But yeah, thanks to technology, I think this could possibly happen. You know, we know where sort of incidents might occur, like accidents on the road. We could manage those things in real time. We could look into ways of just making light pollution a lot better, and we can all reap the rewards.
The thing that's interesting we talked about on the show before is that as lighting becomes cheaper, people use more of it. You know, it's like just the...
Yeah, precisely.
We were talking about this in the context of like, as lighting gets cheaper, people will save money, right? But actually people increase the amount of light that they use.
Yeah, right. Mm. So, I remember when my parents... said like, oh yeah, we must turn out that like the outside door like incandescent bulb when I was a kid because it cost too much. Mm-hmm. Like it literally made a dent on the bills and they were like, no, we're not going to do that. But obviously like a massive floodlight, LED floodlight is like 15 watts. That costs next to nothing.
I got invited to a dark sky conference, although I don't know if I'm
going to go. Oh, yeah, that's right. Oh, lovely.
Yeah, I don't know if that's going to work out or not. It's kind of right around our Australia trip, but it's in the middle of nowhere. Like, it's in, like...
Hell yeah.
Yeah, you have to drive hours away from any mass transit because that's what you have to do to get a fully...
Well, that's precisely where I experienced my dark sky moments, was in the outback of Australia, so...
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Man, that's a sight.
It's just next level. It's just completely off the charts. Like in Brighton, you can see a reasonable amount of stars, but it just doesn't compare.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the same. I mean, even though we live, quote unquote, you know, in the woods, we really live in the suburbs. So on a good night, yeah, the night, the sky is pretty, but it's not dark sky pretty because we still get a glow. There's a glow from the nearby cities, from, you know, like where I am, from New Haven and Bridgeport or whatever. And it reflects off of the clouds, for example. You get
absolutely,
and it completely ruins your ability to really see what's going on. But
do you guys all have telescopes?
Oh yeah,
I do.
Oh yeah. Yep.
I do, yeah.
I got one in my garage.
I'll even point my binoculars to the sky at times because I have nighttime binoculars for stargazing. And those are great as well.
They work well, Ev?
They work very well, actually. Quite well. It's amazing. Nice. You look through these things and you see 1,000 times more things than you see with the naked eye. It's remarkable.
Oh, yeah. Binocular astronomy is fine. You can see lots of planets and stuff with that. It works really well. But it's also one of those things where I just don't see that anything's ever going to be done about it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Well, right? Will virtual reality help some people who can otherwise never have that experience?
Yeah, sure. We'll get it virtually. But, you know, as you say, the advantages of lighting where we live is just so great. I don't see that there's ever going to be enough of a political movement that there's going to be regulations about limiting light pollution.
I completely agree. It's just one of those It's that push of progress. So you can't, like, these are the sort of things, the sort of homogeneity of progress, that these sort of things go by the wayside, these primal things.
Right. Thanks, James.
Thank you.
Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, Columbia University.
You know, it's never too late to start a new intellectual passion, right? Or to learn about something. The question is, would you like to go to an Ivy League university?
Well, you can have that education and so much more at Columbia University School of General Studies. Receive a genuine college experience under the guidance of world-renowned faculty and personalized advice from mentors dedicated to meeting the unique needs of non-traditional students. Students are either just beginning their undergraduate educations or resuming them after taking a break from school. Each general studies student has a different story than they've had careers, served in the military, raised families, and so much more.
And now, obtaining an Ivy League college education is their next milestone. General studies students possess real-world experience, and it's that experience, with research-backed support programs, that inspires a great desire for academic success along the journey to earning a prestigious Columbia University degree.
To discover how you can continue your story, visit gs.columbia.edu/youcan, YOUCAN. Full regular decision application deadline is June 1st. Apply today.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. All right, Evan, so come on, really? Another claim for bacteria on Mars?
Well, yes.
Should we take this seriously?
That's the question, isn't it? Should we take this seriously? We have heard this before. Fossilized bacteria in meteorite from Mars is proof of life, says a new study. A new study. All right. So in order to understand the new study, you have to understand a bit of the history. So I got to take you back to ancient history. Right, James? 1977. We are going all the way back.
Star Wars was released then.
I know. That's what I was thinking too, Bob. In 1977, a Martian meteorite was found in the Allen Hills of Antarctica by a Japanese National Institute of Polar Research mission team. The meteorite was dated as being 175 million years old, and it's a shergatite meteorite, which is composed of igneous rocks, and it's named after the Shergati meteorite discovered in 1865 in Shergati, India. And about three-quarters of all known Martian meteorites are Shergatis, as they say. So this particular Martian meteorite, with the very sensical name of ALH-77005. ALH refers to Allen Hills, 77 being the year of the discovery, and 005 being the fifth sample cataloged that year. That's how those designations work. So ALH-77005 has a composition similar to rocks and atmosphere gases analyzed by Mars spacecraft. We've been able to confirm this recently. And this is how we are 100% sure that these things are from Mars. In fact, the Curiosity rover confirmed the connection between Mars and these meteorites, which have come to Earth, as recently as October 2013. because the rover analyzed argon in the Mars atmosphere, and the argon was found to be the same as argon traces in the meteorites. And there is your positive connection. Now, we've talked about this before on the SGU, about the possibility that there are fossilized microbes within meteorites that have found their way to Earth. The most we've talked about in 1996, wherein a team of scientists led by David McKay announced the discovery of tentative bacteria-like microbial fossils in another meteorite from Allen Hills. That one was the ALH84001. That was a 1984 discovery by U.S. scientists who picked up that particular meteorite. And it ignited a scientific controversy that really continues today and definitely perked up the ears of the general public, especially when then-President Bill Clinton made a public address about the discovery itself. So it definitely became in the public consciousness at that point, certainly the scientific community as well, and have never really looked back. It's continuing to be debated. Now, further studies by other scientists have turned against the life interpretation, saying that what they've discovered in that particular rock are not signatures of life, but rather other natural forms, not derived from any bacteria or anything
geological.
Else. Geological.
Right. Geological. Yeah.
So now scientists in Hungary have added a new study of the ALH77005 meteorite. This was the one that the Japanese researchers discovered in 1977, and they say there's intriguing new evidence. Mineralized and filament-like organic material embedded in the Martian meteorite. They've determined that the material in the meteorite is similar to that produced by iron-oxidizing microbes on Earth. So that means the presence of bacteria which survived by eating iron rust. So what they did is they took a thin section of that sample of that meteorite and studied it using optical microscopy for microtextures. And they found embedded spherical and thread-like structures, materials that represent possible biosignatures. I mean, a lot of this is sounding like also what we heard in 1996 when that announcement came down. But the new part here is the iron oxidizing bacteria. And in fact, the lead scientist on the study, Dr. Ildikó Gyulya from the Hungarian Academy of Sciences, who was the lead researcher, and he wrote in the paper this: comparing recent results and interpretation with other meteorites, it can be raised that on these similarities, the microbially mediated biosignatures can be proposed microbial mediation by iron oxidizing bacteria on Mars. Essentially, our study proposes the presence of microbial mediation on Mars. And they also threw in that there was a strong negative delta C13 enrichment of iron, manganese, and phosphorus and zinc in the shock melt support scenario. So they're saying that that's another set of data that helps them form their conclusion. Okay, so what do you think of that? Iron oxidizing microbes. Evidence of such.
Seems pretty thin.
That's what I thought
pretty
as well.
Thin line of evidence. Yeah.
I mean, what's the level of energy in like an iron oxidizing process? Like, does that exist on the Earth? I literally have no idea.
That's a great question. And we need a chemist, I think, to come on and sort of tell us that whether, how exactly to.
No, no.
How to.
Info at STU.
Right. Right, exactly. I think it raises a lot of the same questions that scientists had, 23 years ago when the 1996 announcement was also made. And, is this enough? Is this enough to effectively move the marker saying, no microbial life to possible microbial life? The fact that this new piece of data has been basically discovered. I don't know.
Yeah, again, possible. What does that mean?
Right.
It's. I think it's still in the realm of sheer speculation.
And we have to wait to hear other interpretations, and obviously other laboratories are, I imagine, going to conduct the same tests to verify the results to see that it is there. But also, does it really get us any closer to trying to make some kind of definitive statement. And I think the fact that, you know, back in 1996, I remember when President Clinton talked about this, and it was a big deal. Do you guys remember?
Yeah.
I don't think we're going to have anything like that again this time around, but it just goes to show you that, yeah, exactly. It continues, you know, the debate continues, the study continues, and there do seem to be various camps here, but I think so far those who are taking the skeptical approach are being the most prudent at this moment.
Yeah, I think so. By the way, as I was looking it up, Evan, so there are three main types of meteorites that have features in common that have been linked to Mars. The biggest group is the Shergotites, but then there's also the Naclites and the Chalcedonites. So some of those features are, you know, it's the type of minerals, it's oxidation, and also it's the fact that they, at some point in their past, they were magma, they were melted. So you need a large enough body to melt the rock. It wouldn't happen in a small asteroid, for example. That was sort of one of the first observations, like, yeah, there's something different about these meteorites, you know, and they sort of grouped them together, and then eventually they were able to make that link to Mars itself. And yes, yeah, so 3/4 of the meteorites that we've discovered so far are in the Shergotite category. And that's just based upon the details of exactly what kind of minerals are found in there and in what forms. But it's interesting all the ways in which all the different lines of evidence by which they said, yeah, these are probably from Mars. And then it was the definitive connection was when they were able to compare it to data that we got back from the probes.
Yeah.
That was
and
there.
They talk about the 1996 announcement sort of being the precursor and almost the relaunching and reinvestment by NASA in going back to Mars to try to find some more definitive answers on.
Yes, I remember that.
So
yeah.
In a way, you know, even though we don't have any definitive answer, we cannot come to any conclusion based on this, but it did cause things to go into motion that did get us, you know, rovers, landers, and observers, satellites and other things all around Mars, which is, you know, we've had great success ever since. So that's a plus.
I wonder if it also, though, contributed to our obsession with going to Mars, which kind of displaced going back to the moon for a couple of decades. And now we're starting to realize, yeah, Mars is too big a goal, man. We should just go to the moon. And now we're sort of refocusing our efforts on the moon. But I wonder how much the, you know, life on Mars bug, as it were,
delayed,
had that
delayed
effect.
Yeah,
what do you guys think about that?
I think that
we'll never know.
I think you need to dispatch Elon Musk. You need to just send him over there, see how he goes.
Yeah,
dispatch him to Mars.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks, yep. Evan. So, Bob, speaking of microbes, what am I going to be able to have a microbial computer?
Microbial. Wow. Yeah, Steve, I think you'll like this one. Researchers have created the most powerful computer-like human cells. Using our friend CRISPR-Cas9, they made biosynthetic dual-core cell computers.
Is it Bob, are these more like Mac or PC?
False dichotomy, Steve. False dichotomy.
Oh, they're Linux. Okay.
This marks a giant step towards creating powerful biocomputers to, among other things, to do things like monitoring our health and even cure diseases potentially. This is one of these news items that I think is for science communicators, like, oh yeah, this is like a little bit of a blip. Oh, that's cool. Next. But I think at some point, I think in the future, we're going to be watching some timelines. And I think that this announcement will be on that timeline for like key technologies and industries that came into its own in the 21st century. I mean, this is one of those things that could really snowball into just massive industries. So this blip, if you will, was created by ETH Zurich, the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich. So, all right, biocomputers. We really haven't discussed them much over the years, I don't think. Biocomputers can come in many forms, but generally they use biological molecules like DNA and proteins to do what a computer does, right? Take input, process and store, and provide output. Pretty simple, right? In this case, it can do all of that with the information that's provided directly from biological systems and from within them as well. So now to do this, the model or template that biotechnologists use it's the obvious one that's provided by our digital world, right? Our ubiquitous computers and chips, which use things like logic gates to process inputs, and they create circuits,
which outputs signal Z when inputs A and B exist, for example, right? So that's the model that biotechnology is kind of basing itself on in a lot of instances. So biotechnologists can create these circuits biologically in cells using protein gene switches. But this is very inflexible, though. Only very simple programming can be used. It's the only thing that's really practical. If you want to do something like complex computations, it's almost impossible. And also, it can only slowly deal with the inputs. Typically, inputs in this instance, I mean like metabolic molecules, not electrons, but things that you will find that cells deal with. So, but cells can actually, I mean, they can't possibly be as fast as electrons are managed within digital circuitry, but cells can process these, metabolic molecules very quickly, perhaps 100,000 different metabolic molecules every second. Imagine a cell dealing with that every second. But the thing is, we've never come close in any type of biocomputer system. We've never been able to come close to reaching that cellular computational capacity, 100,000 per second. But now with this technique, I think we may be able to reach that. The researchers at ETH can now use biological components to make a flexible core processor or CPU of sorts that can deal with different kinds of programming. And it's based on a modified CRISPR-Cas9 system and can manipulate all the RNA-based inputs that we want. So it's not just this, one at a time, but we can kind of do this in parallel and do lots of different types of these inputs that we want. And so the modified Cas9 protein, we've talked about that before, that's really the core of the processor here. It uses as input what's called its guide RNA. And what this guide RNA does is that it helps express a specific gene whose job it is to what? To create a specific protein. So we're creating with this type of setup, what we're doing is we're creating specific types of proteins on demand based on the type of input that comes in. But even more than that, what they've done is that they've created for the first time a dual core processor in a cell using a CRISPR-Cas9 components from two different bacteria. So that's kind of like a really super high level, what they did here. And it's really kind of difficult to drill down and understand exactly how this thing is working. But that said, I think we have very little idea what all the applications that this can lead to. It reminds me of a virtual, augmented reality. I'm sure we're all going to be walking around with our augmented reality glasses in the future, but exactly what we're going to be doing with them is much harder to predict. But regarding these biocomputers, I think it's pretty obvious that what we know that what they should be able to do is they can be used to detect metabolic products or chemical messengers and react to it in specific ways, right? Very simple. You do a detection and then you process that information and then you react to it in specific ways. So what the biocomputer will be able to do is create molecules to perform something like further diagnostics. Like, oh boy, this is something's going on in this person. And we need to diagnose this more. So it could actually create these specific molecules to determine, to get more information about what's going on. Or if it really has a good handle on what's going on, it could then potentially create pharmaceutical substances to treat the problem. So think about that. You could detect what the problem is and then actually create some of the medicines that would be needed to actually deal with it. And of course, cancer detection and treatment. This is Martin Fussenegger. He said, imagine a microtissue with billions of cells, each equipped with its own dual core processor. Such computational organs could theoretically attain computing power that far outstrips that of a digital supercomputer and using just a fraction of the energy. So what are we going to see beyond this? I mean, what's the future of this? I think the more short term that we'll see here, instead of dual core, I think we'll start seeing multi-core computer structures, being implemented into human cells. And of course, if you go from dual to multi-core, we know from our own digital computers that that's going to offer even more computation ability. And who knows where this is going to end? I mean, I really think this could spawn whole industries.
Right. But it's always fun, like when you talk about processing, like everyone thinks of computers, but actually there's a lot of things other than running a desktop, that processors can do.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's interesting, Steve, because that you say that, because this Martin said that he was another interesting quote I wanted to say. He said, this cell computer may sound very revolutionary, but that's not the case. The human body itself is a large computer. Its metabolism has drawn on the computing power of trillions of cells since time immemorial. These cells continually receive information from the outside world or from other cells, process the signals, and respond accordingly, whether it's by emitting chemical messengers or triggering metabolic processes. And it's true. And I love how he closes that. And in contrast to a technical supercomputer, this large computer needs just a slice of bread for energy. And this is kind of what we're doing with these biocomputers. We're just kind of like, creating our own little biocomputers in the body to do what our body's already doing, but in a much more targeted, efficient, and yeah. helpful way than even, millions of years of evolution have afforded us.
Yeah, but I agree with you. I think we have no idea what the yeah. actual applications are going yeah. to be. But that's kind of exciting, sure. too. It's like, God, how is this going to play itself out? We don't know. What new technology that we can't even imagine right now is going to spawn from this? That's cool. All right. Thanks, Bob. Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right. Last week, I played this noisy. That's pretty weird, isn't it? What do you guys think it is? What the hell is that?
It's my dog, Molly, begging for food.
It's one of those like whistly sort of things with the rod at the bottom and you're...
Slide whistle?
Yeah, slide whistle.
Remember what my clue was last week, that this is
yes.
data turned into music from something.
Earthquakes.
I guess there isn't a bad guess. No? Right? Because it's...
That's the best you can hope for.
Yeah, like, okay, that earthquakes are cool. Yes. A listener named Visto Tutti, that is a cool name, wrote in and said, I think the data rendered to sound is respiration and heartbeat. That's a really... provocative guess, like, because if you listen to back to it, it has that rhythm. Listen. That's a good guess. It's not correct. And this listener also wrote in and said the pronunciation of the Australian bird, the EMU, right? That's what it's how you spell it, is...
Yes, it's EMU.
EMU. It is EMU. We were wrong, yeah. And we are sorry to everyone that lives in that part of the world. Another person wrote in and said, who is this? Keith Harrison said, hi, Rogues. I recognize this noisy right away. And this person happens to be the winner. And Keith said, it's the data from the Huygens. You guys hear about this? The Huygens?
Oh, sure.
Probe.
The Huygens probe, which was carried by Cassini to Titan and yeah. descended through Titan's atmosphere. The noisy goes along with a beautiful set of graphics that depict altitude, rotation rate, acquisition of images, and various other events.
You know, they got the name for that probe from Star Wars, Shay.
Huygens?
Really? Cassini! Cassini!
So listen one last time, now that you know that this is a probe entering into Titan's atmosphere. It's a really cool noisy. Unique, I dare say.
Sure.
So that noisy was sent in again by a listener named Kat Brazil. So thanks for that. That's really fun. I like those. Some of these interpreted data noisies are really spectacularly cool. So I have a new noisy for this week.
Mm-hmm.
And the noisy is... What do you think of that?
It kind of sounds like who's that 80s character that had all the sort of block face and he was like the
Max Headroom?
Yes.
Max.
It's almost like that.
Wow. So that was that new noisy, by the way, was sent in by a listener named Bob Benedict. Thank you, Bob. That's a really cool noisy. I'm looking forward to letting you guys know what it's about. So listen, if you heard any cool noisies this week, and I yelled at everyone last week. I did. I yelled at all the listeners to say, damn it, I know you heard something cool. And I got some really fun noises. Now, you know, I'm particular about these. They have to be just right for me to play them on the show. So if you send something in and I don't use it, please don't get upset. I'm just being very particular because we want the show to be as good as possible. And if you have a guess on what this week's noisy is, you could write me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Steven.
Yeah.
I got to tell you, we've got a great turnout for the no-show, which we're doing with George Traub on the 26th of this month. I'm very pleased. We've got a lot of good people coming. It's, you know, we got the numbers increase as the day goes on because the show, it runs from noon until 10 p.m. So it's an all-day thing. Those people that are showing up at noon that bought tickets for the LARP are going to be having lunch with us. But we still have a ton of other things going on that day. So if you're interested in going, you can go to noshow.eventbrite.com. It's not too late, and we're going to be there hanging out all day.
And don't forget about Nexus, July 11th to 14th in New York City. One of our speakers this year is – our keynote speaker is Carl Zimmer. If you don't know who he is an excellent science communicator, author of many books. If you haven't heard him lecture before, you're in for a treat. Carl is awesome. He's the author of books such as She Has Her Mother's Laugh, A Planet of Viruses, Evolution, Making Sense of Life, and others. So come to Nexus. We'll, of course, the SU will be there. We'll be having a stage show, a private show, and an extravaganza. And there'll be lots of other cool stuff going on. All right, let's move on to some emails. We got a lot of follow-up on our flying car discussion, which to me is an indication that people want to talk about it. I also blogged about it, and there was so much feedback I had to write a follow-up, and there was a lot of feedback to that. So I just want to quickly encapsulate, I think, what the net result of all this feedback and all this discussion was. The idea was that we brought up last week, is there any scenario in which flying cars might actually be cost-effective? Because that is certainly a barrier to their adoption. And the conventional wisdom has been, well, it's so much more costly to fly than to roll along the ground that they're never going to be cost-effective. They're always going to be just a rich boy's toy. But this analysis said, no, there are some situations in which a flying car could actually be energy effective and therefore cost effective. And those include situations in which the trip is fairly long, like over 100 kilometers, because it's more efficient than the ascent and ascending and descending. And then also if there's a lot of traffic or if there's a lot of geographical obstacles to ground transportation, they could, you know, flying cars could actually be more energy effective, and they could also be massively more time effective. And we all know how valuable time is. Oh, but the authors also did a curious thing, which I admit was the weakest part of their paper, and I was not impressed with. They said, if you compare a fully loaded flying car with like three passengers to, or the average passengers traveling in a ground car, which is 1.57, then, you know, that also makes the flying car more effective in comparison. But yeah, that's an apples to oranges comparison. They were trying to make a point that if you carpool, you know, in the flying cars, it could be more effective. But just forget that. That was, a lot of people got distracted by that point. That has nothing really to do with the core of what they're saying, which is, yeah, traffic, geography, and distance, if you have those variables, one passenger to one passenger, that a flying car can be more effective than a gasoline car and almost as cost effective as an electric car. Electric cars will still beat the flying car unless you have a really horrible geographical choke point or obstacle. Like you have to drive around a lake or you have like a bridge. It's going to take you an hour to get across the bridge because of traffic or whatever, something horrible like that. So the question becomes then, what are the scenarios in which, you know, what's the niche? Where is the flying car going to be adopted? And I broke it down further when I was writing about it. I said, there's really three things to think about. There's trip efficiency, there's ownership efficiency, and then there's societal efficiency. So very quickly, we really only talked about trip efficiency. That's getting from A to B, is that going to be time and energy efficient to drive or to fly? And again, I gave the parameters for when flying is better. For ownership efficiency, like should I buy a flying car or should I buy a ground car? And that, I think for the foreseeable future, buying a flying car is not really going to be tenable as your only source of transportation. I think I could only see it as like an extra thing. Like if you have a If you're a two or three car family, one of those vehicles could be a flying car. So if you have the option of using the ground car when that's more efficient and the flying car when that's more efficient, that would make sense. But of course, I think the ownership efficiency gets largely rendered moot when you consider
driving.
The Uber service.
How about autonomous?
Yeah, fleet-based, not ownership-based. And Uber's already looking into developing flying cars for their services. So you were just – when it's like, oh, God, the weather's perfect, but traffic is terrible. I'm just going to hire an Uber flying car and get to where I need to go in a third of the time or a quarter of the time. So I think that's probably where it's going to be used. And it's very much going to be this – I think, at least for the foreseeable future. But again, the key is this is a niche where it can fill and make sense, where when the situation is ripe and the service is available, people will pay for it, you know, if the service is available. And I think that could actually be a viable business model, and in which case that's sort of a leg in for a flying car industry. Societal efficiency is if we add flying cars to our all of the other travel options that we have, will that be a net benefit, a net negative, or neutral in terms of just overall energy expenditure and travel efficiency? And that's a really, really hard question to answer because there's so many moving parts there. There's a lot of discussion about whether or not it would reduce traffic, and I think the evidence basically says we don't know, but because there's, you know, how do you really test that? There are suggestions that adding public transport, if you consider this like an additional form of non-road-based transport, it does reduce traffic in those corridors where you're adding the extra options. But we don't really have the research to give us that answer.
Also, like you're battling against physics, right? You're still going to have these propeller based drone based things that will just be going like making an absolutely racket. Like there's nothing that you can do against that. Like how many people are going to sort of just be like, no, I don't want that. Mm. I do not want that.
Well, I think some people brought up the noise factor, but we know that you can. You can engineer silent helicopters, right?
That almost sounds like a skeptical myth. Like, can you really do that? Like, you've seen it. I remember you saying that the sort of CIA, we can make silent helicopters. But that sounds just completely ludicrous.
Black helicopters. That was the claim. The night, yeah. That was the claim that was made. But I think at the very least, not necessarily. Steve. Yeah, yeah. Not necessarily silent, but at least, you know, so that will be one question. Can you make them quiet enough that they are not noisier than gasoline cars?
Precisely.
You know? I think if they're electric, you know, that will go a long way.
Help.
I mean, they have to be electric.
Oh, yeah.
People brought up a lot of things like, you know, the blowback when they take off and land. Like, yeah, there's going to need to be an infrastructure.
Oh,
there's
going
to need to be places where you take off and land and where they get recharged. Absolutely. But as they get incorporated, I think the infrastructure will adapt. I mean, think about all the infrastructure we needed to add just to introduce cars to society. It was massive.
Oh, yeah.
Massive. This, I think, would be less. It would be less infrastructure. That's the big advantage of flying cars is you don't need roads or rails or tunnels or bridges.
You just
need a place.
Helipads sort of port, maybe that's it.
You just need a big enough space to safely land and take off.
Yeah, these things are going to need to communicate with each other too, so they don't accidentally bump into each other. By the way,
safety came up. It's like, yeah, but guys, we're talking about will these eventually be adopted? Like, you know, 50 years from now, when you have completely self-flying cars that are communicating to each other and the grid and over the internet, and they're just basically flying themselves, they'll stay out of the ways of airports. They'll be at the right altitudes, whatever. They'll be perfectly safe. So if we can't crack that, I don't think that's going to be the limiting factor is the bottom line, the safety, because I think that we'll just have the technology to do that. And I think probably the most valid point that people raised saying that that would limit the adoption is weather.
Mm.
Because any flying thing is not going to be good, especially really lightweight vehicles flying relatively close to the ground, closer than, say, airplanes that'll be flying at much higher.
Yep.
Because they lose all their efficiency if you make them go super high, right? That's the cost effectiveness goes out the window. They're going to be flying. I see them as flying like from rooftop to rooftop or garage top to garage top, you know, in cities,
locations, or from like your driveway to a garage or something, and staying above obstacles, but not any higher than they absolutely need to go. But the problem is that that is inherently dangerous because you're flying technically then near to obstacles, and any kind of weather could make it really dangerous. So how viable is a transportation option where there are days when it just can't use it? You know, if like there's too much wind, the wind's over a certain number of miles per hour, the entire fleet is grounded, right? I mean, they just can't use them. That's a good point. That's a significant limitation. That all we could say is, well, as the technology advances and the engineering and the software and everything gets better, the days in which you'll be able to use them will be more. And again, maybe it'll be a really great in cities that have very few windy days, you know, that just have good weather for whatever reason.
Not Brighton, I'm sorry.
Not Brighton. Yeah. All of these points point to the conclusion that it will have a certain niche, but that's it. It's like the Segway. It's not going to replace walking, but there are people who are going to use it in certain circumstances, and it'll be advantageous in those conditions. I mean, just the potential advantages when you can use it can be huge. So sure, I don't think it's going to replace the family car. I don't think we were saying that it would. I think it will be an additional option that will get used when it's advantageous. And there are situations for which it's energy efficient, time efficient, and can be safe and convenient. I think that's the bottom line. Will it ever come to pass? Who knows? Nice. I don't think we can say that at this point. I think, you know, I'm closer to thinking that it will with this most recent analysis. That was really the only point I was making.
I'd love to see it, but I don't, like, can you imagine it being literally next door, like having a port next door? That's the problem that I see, is the sort of NIMBYs, and I would probably be one of them, I have to say.
Yeah, who knows? There might be zoning issues. You know, you might need to have a certain amount of space around your helipad or whatever before you could use it. It might be like owning a horse, you know, like not everyone's going to have it, but if you have enough property, you could do it. Who knows? Or they're just, you know, it might be that you have to drive. You know how you could drive to a place where you then get on the bus or the train or whatever? Yeah. Same thing. Yeah, you just drive to a garage and then you take the, you know, that is easy to get to. And then you take the flying car from that point past all the congestion into the city or whatever, and then you, right? I think as one leg of your trip, it could be useful. All right, so thanks to everybody who wrote in about that. I'm sure we'll get more feedback. I consider it all to be an interesting thought experiment, because that's really all it is at this point. Okay, one quick name that logical fallacy. I've been kind of sitting on this one for a few weeks. This one comes from Chris Beck, who writes, I have the feeling that simply using the phrase quote-unquote big pharma is somehow a logical fallacy unto itself, but I can't quite categorize it. Can you help? What do you guys think? What kind of logical fallacy is big pharma?
Well, I saw this in the show notes, and I thought it deserved a bit more expanding. Like, it was a really humble post from the chat.
Yeah.
I got the feeling that, I mean, I feel like that when I... How on earth do I, even as a technical person, parse paper that's not even close to the field that I'm even interested in?
But so when you think just by invoking big pharma, are you committing a logical fallacy, or does it depend?
Well, I'm sure you know very well, Steve, like big pharma, big quote unquote big pharma, has problems. It has to. It's a human endeavor.
But so then the question then becomes, what are you implying something when you use that phrase?
Yeah, that, correct.
Right? So, yeah, no one – so that's a straw man, right? If you're saying that you're distinguishing big pharma from this notion that the pharmaceutical industry is beyond reproach or they're perfect, no one, I think, says that. So if that's your claim, if that is an implied claim here, then that is a straw man.
Right, yeah.
But the first thing that occurred to me was that it's poisoning the well, right? That by saying big pharma, it's the equivalent of a personal attack, in that you're trying to taint the industry with the implication that it has more power than it does, that it's somehow involved in some big conspiracy, that everything is like it's one monolithic industry, which it isn't. You know, these are individual companies who may be working even against each other. It's essentially conspiracy mongering, right?
Mm, yep.
By implication. So sometimes we call this more of a gambit than a logical fallacy. You know what I mean? This is like the big pharma gambit or the toxin gambit, where you're throwing out a concept that is mostly poisoning the well, but you're trying to imply a lot of things, often some kind of conspiracy with that statement. Like there's deliberate baggage that you want to go along with it. It's the baggage is the feature, right? It's a feature, not a bug, right? Yeah, power and malice, basically. I think are the two implications there.
Sure. A big boardroom of chortling executives, just like ha ha ha, we're getting one over these people, like that typical view,
right? And also that the entire industry's in on it.
Yeah, right. Right. Everyone.
They're the evil empire.
Right, right. Thanks for that question, Chris. Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, LinkedIn.
When it's time to make a hire for your small business, you want to find the best person that you can for the job. And, you know, the odds are that that person actually is on LinkedIn right now. LinkedIn Jobs makes it easy to get matched with quality candidates using the knowledge of both hard skills and soft skills to match you with the people who fit your role the best.
People come to LinkedIn every day to learn and advance their career. So LinkedIn understands what they're interested in and what they're looking for. So when you use LinkedIn Jobs to hire someone, your matches are based on more than a resume. Your matches are based on skills and background, but also interests, activities, and passions. Matching lets you quickly get a group of the most relevant qualified candidates for your role so you can focus on the candidates you want to spend time talking to and make a quality hire you're excited about.
So post a job today at linkedin.com/skeptics and get $50 off your first job post. That's linkedin.com/skeptics. Terms and conditions apply.
All right, let's get back to the show.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. James, just for you this week, I have a theme. Are you ready to hear the theme?
What is it?
The theme is astronomy. Pretty big theme, just a category. Yeah.
My news item was quite astronomy based.
Yes.
So I'm happy with that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. So we'll see how you do with these three items. Here they are. Item number one. Astronomers have observed a super flare from our sun 10 times as powerful as the Carrington event, although safely pointed away from the Earth. Item number two, astronomers report the confirmation of 7 exoplanets with periods greater than 15 years, the longest greater than 40 years. And item number three, new measurements find that while Mercury's outer core is molten, its inner core is solid and about the same size as the Earth's. All right, James, as our guest rogue, you get to go first.
Oh my God, it's the peril. I don't know. So the astronomers have observed a super flare from our sun. I mean, 10 times more powerful. It doesn't matter. Like the arc that it would have to, like the Carrington event is so unlikely that it was going to come to us. Like, yeah, I've got to buy that one, really. So the report on the confirmation of 7 exoplanets with periods greater than 15 years, the longest greater than 40 years. The thing that I struggle with that is that, I mean, some of those things are all sort of transitory method stuff. So I mean, how long have we been looking at this stuff? Like 40 years? Like, what kind of confirmation do you need from that? To be honest, I don't really know, but I might come back to that one. Okay, so new measurements find that while Mercury's outer core is molten, the inner core is solid. I literally have no idea how that would occur. But I mean, weirder happen. Stranger things happen at sea. I don't know. Like, so it's definitely between those last two. So I'm just going to have to put my nickel down, as you would say. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have to go for the Mercury outer core because that just seems pretty intense. I reckon they've done some tomfoolery with the exoplanets, but the Mercury outer core. That sounds strange to me.
That's the fiction.
Yes.
All right, Evan.
Oh, boy. The Carrington event. Oh, my gosh. I love when we talk about things related to this. But they observed a super flare from our sun 10 times as powerful. I've been trying to keep track of these news items as they come out. I didn't hear about this. I know a few years back, there was one that it was a flare that missed the Earth by a couple days, I think. It was pretty darn close. So these things do happen 10 times as powerful as the Carrington event and safely pointed away. I did not hear this. Next one, astronomers report the confirmation of 7 exoplanets with periods greater than 15 years. Wow. The longest greater than 40 years. I don't know much about these periods and how extreme or within the norm these things might be. So I don't have a good frame of reference here on this one. And then Mercury. Okay, so the outer core is molten. The inner core is solid, but about the same size as Earth's. I always thought Mercury, the special thing about Mercury's core is that compared to its size, it has the largest core of any planet. And I also recall, what is it, the Messenger craft has gone to Mercury and has picked up a whole ton of new data that we didn't even come close to knowing about Mercury before. So we've learned a lot about Mercury in recent years, which leads me to believe that that one's actually going to wind up being the science. So therefore, I'll put my 10 pence down on that is still a British currency, right? Oh, crumbs.
It's not worth much, but yeah, whatever.
Well, there's not much science informing me on my decision this week. It's more or less what did I hear, what didn't I hear. I don't know. I thought I would have heard something about that Carrington event because I have always have my ears and eyes open for Carrington event like things. I didn't hear it. So I think that one's the fiction. I think, Steve, you made that up.
Okay. Jay?
I will take these in a randomized order. So the last one about Mercury's outer core is molten. Its inner core is solid and about the same size as Earth's. I don't see any reason to think any of this is wrong. It makes sense that Mercury's outer core is molten. It also makes sense that there is something solid inside, and I just don't have any reason to doubt that it would be roughly Earth size. Going to the second one here about the 7 exoplanets with periods greater than 15 years, longest greater than 40 years, I don't have much to say about that one. So I think on the first one, I agree with Evan. Number one, 10 times as powerful as the Carrington event. Yeah, I know that would have made massive news unless it literally just came out very recently, which I know Steve likes to do. They call this a super flare, by the way, Ev. Did you know that?
No. Yeah, actually, I did know that. Yes.
I don't think that there are super flares that are 10 times the size of the Carrington event. Hands down, I just don't think they exist. So I think that one's a fiction.
And Bob?
Let's go with we'll start with three here. The big thing here is that the inner core is the same size as the Earth. Sure, that's like what the hell is going on there. But if you consider that Mercury, I mean, perhaps that means that Mercury is the result of a planetary collision that basically stripped away the outer part, like the crust and mantle. Or some of the mantle of a planet and left just the core of the planet. Maybe that could explain it, but it doesn't sound too crazy to me. The second one, the exoplanet orbital periods, it's 7, 15, and 40 years, big deal. I mean, yeah, they have long years. That doesn't sound too crazy. Yeah, it's the first one. It's a Carrington event one that's striking me as odd. I agree with Jay that I'm not even sure the sun can produce a super flare an order of magnitude more powerful than the Carrington event. And I'll go with Evan's reasoning as well, that I would have heard about it. I wouldn't say I have a Google alert for Carrington event, but now that I think of it, maybe I should.
I'm going to set one up tonight, I think.
Doesn't sound too believable to be that big.
So you guys are leaving our poor guest out in the cold all by himself.
But
maybe a little.
I know how many arc seconds it takes to spray the Earth with something, but I don't know, maybe you know something you know something that I don't.
Well, let's start in the middle with number two, since you all agree with that one. Astronomers report the confirmation of 7 exoplanets with periods greater than 15 years, the longest greater than 40 years. You all think this one is science, and this one is science. Yeah, there's okay. So much exoplanet stuff going on, it's hard to doubt anything. But the idea here is the periods are surprising, right? That there's
40 is big.
It takes a long time to confirm exoplanets with long periods because they have, like, if you're using the transit method, they have to pass in front of their star three times, which means it's at least like twice its orbital period. So we would have to have been observing an exoplanet with a period of 40 years for 80 years to confirm it with the transit method.
Happening.
So clearly that's not the method they were using. This is the Euler telescope, E-U-L-E-R. I don't know if it's supposed to be pronounced that way.
I think that's right.
The U-N-I-G-E, Unige, or if you're not even supposed to pronounce that, is it initialism or an acronym?
Yeah, right? I don't know.
Astronomy department, and this is one of those situations where the press release was just not good, and I had to go like to other supportive material to find out what the hell they were talking about. So, like, what method was actually used to find these planets? It wasn't the transit method, so it was hard to really nail this down. But I think what they used to actually detect these planets was the radial velocity method. And the Euler telescope and the Corrales spectrograph, which is the specific instrument that they're using, has been able to increase, Bob, check this out, the accuracy of the radial velocity method to within a few meters per second. So this is basically determining how fast it's moving. This could allow the detection of planets with a mass as small as Neptune's.
Whoa.
But there's a limit in terms of like how much you could determine about them. Although there was a recent study I found, again, trying to do some background research to figure out what the hell they're talking about here. Using this telescope, astronomers are developing methods where they can confirm the orbits of planets as well as their mass and their distance with just one pass. So with either just one transit, one observation. So this reduces the time significantly that it takes to confirm certain exoplanets.
Sure.
But with these exoplanets, so again, as best as I could tell, because they didn't just flat out state it in any of the material I could find, I had to piece this together, they used radial velocities to confirm that they exist, but now they are targets for direct observation. Now that we know these planets are there, we could then try to observe them directly because they are big enough and far enough away from their parent star that we might be able to do that. Does that make sense?
Cool. Yeah. Cool. Mm-hmm.
Sure it does.
Yeah. So we used multiple methods, and we to back up each other and to get more information about these individual exoplanets. But these most recent crop of planets, of exoplanets, were the result of 20 years of continuous observation. This is sort of the big news about this, that the Euler telescope has been in continuous use for exoplanet discovery for 20 years. And it's these long observation that has allowed the confirmation of these planets with such long periods.
Tour de force.
Cool. Yeah, very, very cool. We have confirmed over 4,000 exoplanets so far. 4,000.
That is insane. That is like the just merest smattering of
this. Yeah, all in our lifetime. Very cool. All right, let's go back to number one. Astronomers have observed a superflare from our sun 10 times as powerful as the Carrington event, although safely pointed away from the Earth. James, you think that this one is science. Everyone else thinks this one is the fiction, and the fiction.
Yeah,
I couldn't slip a super flare past you guys, huh? So the astronomers did recently observe a super flare 10 times more powerful than the Carrington event, but it was on a nearby star. It wasn't on our star.
Was it 10 times bigger? Wow.
Yeah, 10 times more powerful. Now, the Carrington event is still the most powerful confirmed superflare or coronal mass ejection from our own star, pointing at the Earth or not. So it would be news if our star belched out something that big. It would be huge news. Not that it never has. It's that, we either has to be observed or it would have had to hit the Earth and we had the evidence of it.
Right.
So, a big one, sure, 1,000 years ago, did one pointing away from the Earth belch from the sun? Who the hell knows? We have no way of knowing that.
This is kind of irritating for me because I literally went to a sun exhibition at the Science Museum in London, and there was mentions of all the Carrington events, and I don't know, it gave me a false sense of security, and it's... half past you knew three something. In the morning as well.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, a little knowledge noted. Can be dangerous.
Noted. What's really interesting about this, because we've seen bigger super flares from exosuns, right, from other stars before. But what's interesting about this one is that it came from an ultra-cool star that's almost the same size as Jupiter. This is just about as small as you can get and still be a star. Yeah, it's almost a brown dwarf. It's almost substellar, but they're saying this is a stellar object. It's a small star. It should be really cool. These really ultra-cool stars shouldn't be putting out flares like this. So what caused...
Is it young?
I don't know.
Some young stars are very active, but...
Yeah.
Still very tiny.
Could it be some sort of swallowing event? Like it took on some sort of mass? I don't know.
It didn't. There's no collision? Information. I think they just observed it. There's like no. I don't think there's a collision. Maybe we'll learn more about this in the days ahead, but that's the information I have available to me right now. But that was of this. Another star, not our own. But you're right, Bob. Imagine 10 times a Carrington event hitting the Earth now. It would wipe out our technology.
Yeah. Even military shielded technology would probably be fried.
So all of this means that new measurements find that while Mercury's outer core is molten, its inner core is solid and about the same size as Earth's is science. This is an evidence. Did you read this one? Because you pretty much nailed it. This is the Messenger probe, which is doing gravity measurements of Mercury. And it's the gravity measurements that allow you to determine things like what the middle of the planet, how it's structured, right? So like the Earth, right, we have a core, and the core has an outer liquid core and an inner solid core. Now, the outer core and the inner core are made of the same material, mostly iron and nickel. So do you guys know why the inner core is solid and the outer core is liquid?
Steve, are you trying to subtly...
Tidal forces, I imagine, something like
that. How about just the pressure?
Pressure. Bob got it right. It's the pressure.
Pressure. Of course.
So wait, does this have anything to do with the saber core lightsaber I want?
No, it does not have anything
saber
to do with
forge,
that.
Saber forge, but you're right.
Yeah. Okay. So it's all about pressure. Right. So basically, it's hot enough. The core is the inner part of the planet that's hot enough still to keep iron and nickel molten, but as you get far enough down, it gets solid because of the pressure. So the question is, why does Mercury have such a damn big inner solid core when it's a lot smaller of a world than the Earth is? And I think the bottom line is we don't know.
Well, could it be could Mercury be the product of a collision and where the outer part of the planet was stripped away?
I don't know.
Rule that out?
They didn't say one way or the other.
That's my theory.
Yeah, could be. But it's interesting to see a side-by-side of the Earth and Mercury. Mercury is teeny. It is small compared to the Earth. Yeah. It is like moon-sized almost.
Yeah.
There's no moon.
That's no moon.
It's planet Vulcan.
Cool. Mercury's an interesting little world there. But its crust is solid. Doesn't have tectonic plates. The smaller you are, the more quickly your crust solidifies and you lose your geological activity.
Makes sense.
All right. Well, good job, guys. James, it's hard being first. It's hard. Yeah. And this is your first science or fiction. So I feel you. And it's
totally in the middle of the night.
Yeah. And it's 3:00 in the morning.
Absolutely.
No, it's very all good. Very I've challenging. Had a lot of fun. Thank you very much for hosting me. Thank you.
Awesome.
Well, hang on. Don't get ahead of yourself. Evan has to give us the quote.
That's right.
We've got a quote.
The bottom line is that humans are very bad at understanding probability. Everyone finds it difficult. Even I do. We just have to get better at it. We need to learn to spot when we are being manipulated. That's the key, when we're being manipulated. David Spiegelhalter. He's the Winton Professor for the Public Understanding of Risk at the University of Cambridge. And I got this from an article in which he was interviewed from a couple of years back. And we talk about this quite often in regards to skepticism.
Yeah. Yep, the understanding of risk. Most people grossly over and underestimate relative risk.
That's
of various
why we're
things.
Aboard her.
That's right. and those who know that people have a poor understanding of this use that sometimes to their advantage.
Right. Or fearmonger about GMOs or whatever. All ties back.
It does.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Evan. Hey, thank you all for joining me this week. And James, thanks for joining us. It's been a lot of
fun.
Thanks,
James.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thanks, James.
This is great, James. Thanks for joining us.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.